The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Now, this week marks the 80th birthday of former President Bill Clinton. To mark the occasion, we're going to be looking back at some of the biggest scandals in U.S. history to see how American politics has changed and how different presidents dealt with political scandals. Joining me in studio here is Dr. Charles Larkin, Director of Research at the Institute of Policy Research at Bath University and co-director of the Kennedy Summer School in New Ross, which we will be actually going to in a couple of weeks' time, and I'm looking forward to that. But Christian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Pat.
Now, we want to go back to, first of all, the original impeachment. Who was the first president to be impeached?
Well, that would be Andrew Johnson, and that was immediately after the Civil War. And his impeachment took place in 1867, and it related to the dismissal of what was then called the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton.
Now, an impeachment is an indictment. It's not a conviction.
It is the articles of impeachment are approved by the House of Representatives and then sent to the Senate. And the Senate acts as the court of law headed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
So was Johnson convicted?
He was not convicted. And you need a two-thirds majority to convict in the Senate. And that applies not only to the president, but also to federal judges.
But you can send someone from the House to be impeached by a simple majority?
Correct.
So one vote is enough to get it to the Senate.
To get it to the Senate. But then there's quite the hurdle to make it through to a conviction in the Senate.
So then we move to the modern era and the fate of Richard Nixon. It's very interesting because it was all about Watergate.
Yes. Well, of course, in the case of Richard Nixon, it's a very interesting situation that Richard Nixon knew that he was on a very rapid march towards impeachment. But as he went along that march and he was accused of obstruction of justice and various other activities, he decided to preserve the dignity of the presidency by resigning before the impeachment was approved
because
in the House.
Because there would have been bipartisan support for his conviction.
There would have been bipartisan support for his conviction, but the question is, would there be two-thirds support in the Senate? And in order to avoid what was at the time considered a very profound blight upon the presidency, he decided to forego that process and resign in advance. And importantly, President Ford subsequently decided that it was important to provide a pardon to President Nixon. And his view was that this preserved the presidency's dignity, but also by Nixon accepting the pardon, that by accepting the pardon, there was an imputation of guilt through its acceptance. And that acts as a confession of guilt on the part of the party that is receiving it.
Let's hear Nixon talking about his decision to go and saying farewell to his staff.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
So that was Nixon saying farewell to his staff, that last little bit there. How did he fare post his resignation? I mean, was he ever rehabilitated? We know recently J.D. Vance tried to dismiss Watergate as basically a trivia.
I think it's important to note that Nixon never was rehabilitated, and Nixon knew that himself. He went into a very quiet post-presidency position. He did have the famous interviews, those interviews basically
David Frost,
with David Frost, and those effectively, he convicted himself out of his own mouth. What was important was not so much Nixon's behavior afterwards, it was the people that were around him. And the idea of the Nixon principle that if the president does it, it's not against the law, became sort of a cri de coeur for a conservative wing of the Republican Party beginning in the 1970s.
Did many of his acolytes go to jail?
Some of his acolytes went to jail, those that actually did the breaking in. There was one additional pardon at the time to an assistant of his. But those that were in the cabinet did not. They went on to glittering careers in the West Wing and elsewhere. One, of course, being in the Ford administration was Henry Kissinger. And then, of course, we have people like Donald Rumsfeld. But importantly, at the same time, there were people that were more junior who were thrown into the cold. And one of those was Roger Stone and Paul Manafort. And the creation of Roger Stone's and Paul Manafort's lobbying firm is a direct consequence of that group of individuals that were quite supportive of Nixon, but found themselves as pariahs afterwards.
And then, of course, they lay in the long grass of lobbying until their moment came under Donald Trump.
Correct. And in fact, that firm's relationship with Donald Trump goes back to the early 80s. And they see their moment in basically the second wave of conservatism, which arises after the contract with America and the Republican Revolution of 1994.
Now, the peculiar thing, the Watergate affair was a break-in to the National Democratic offices in the Watergate Hotel. And Nixon didn't order it, didn't even know about it, but he got into trouble for the cover-up when he did find out about it.
Yes, and that's the critical thing. And if you were to see a lesson from the Nixon Watergate scandal, it's that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up that gets you into trouble. And that's sort of been one of the consistent themes. And one of the superpowers, so to speak, of Donald Trump is that his shamelessness has so far enabled him to get away with things because he does not try to hide the crimes. He has them in plain sight, and he realizes that the cover-up gets you into more trouble.
Now, we know, and we'll be talking with Luke O'Neill about Dr. Fauci in a few minutes' time, and he got a pardon from Joe Biden in case the Trump regime would go after him, which they have done. Those around Trump don't seem to be fearful that they will be effectively probably indicted and jailed. They don't seem to fear that because they expect some sort of pardons in advance from Trump.
Yes, and President Trump has been very explicit about this, that I think there was a quote from him saying that anyone that comes within 200 feet of the Oval Office will be receiving a pardon from him. And that is part of how he is obtaining the compliance and activity of his staff, is on the basis that when we leave, you'll be part of the group getting pardons.
Mind you, they have to be careful that Trump can only pardon federal crimes. If they have committed crimes in a state, they can still be done, and they may well be. And now let's move on to Bill Clinton.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible.
Now, the whole Monica Lewinsky thing is a fairly sordid affair. On, if you like, both sides. I mean, the fact that the president was carrying on with an unpaid intern was one thing. But then the whole Linda Tripp saga on the other side and the Kenneth Starr saga, that was fairly unseemly as well.
Yes, I mean the end of the Clinton administration was singularly unpleasant, and while we look back on the Clinton administration with somewhat rose-tinted glasses now, it's important to remember that Al Gore was sufficiently disturbed by the scandals of the Clinton administration that he didn't want him campaigning during his presidential election.
Which may have been a mistake.
Which probably was a mistake, because Bill Clinton has always been an excellent campaigner. But those scandals were all-consuming at the time. And to give you a sense of just how divided the Senate was, when he did go to his impeachment trial in the Senate, it was a straight 50-50 vote. Now, of course, that wasn't the two-thirds required to convict, but it shows you that in the room, half the senators felt that he was guilty.
And half were prepared to liberate him.
Yes.
And that shows the partisan nature of the chamber at that time, which has persisted since.
It has. And that, I mean, if you look at the Nixon White House, you know, that was a White House and a Congress that everyone tried to work to progress policy. And a lot of key policies moved forward during that White House time. If you look at the Clinton administration, that's the beginning of the hyper-partisanship. And it is with the Republican Revolution in 1994 and Newt Gingrich's dominance of the House of Representatives. And that was the first time we have a full government shutdown. Now, I mean, at the time, that was considered a very, very big deal. But that was a mere 21 days, which are sort of baby numbers compared to the shutdown since. So it is a very significant watershed.
But Clinton has been rehabilitated.
He has largely been rehabilitated. What is more open to conversation is whether or not his third way approach to politics laid the foundations for crises that happened in the early 2000s. Mm. The move towards the Clinton crime bill and mass incarceration from his first term. You have in his second term the Gramm-Leach-Bailey Act, which repeals the Glass-Steagall Act, which deregulates and desupervises a lot of the financial services sector, which gives us the financial crisis. So there are many things which people are quite supportive of what Bill Clinton had achieved. But at the same time, a lot of the third way solutions he had at the time laid the foundations for future problems which were dealt with in the mid-2000s.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Donald Trump acts with total impunity, that he does everything in plain sight. And this is the man actually saying that's exactly what he can do.
They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible. No, they say, Trump, we love you too, man. Trump's voters are by far, you know, I'm at 68, 69%. I'm at 90% total. Like, will you stay? Absolutely. I think it's 68 or 69%. Will you most likely stay? That gets into the 90s. Other guys are like a 10.
Now, that's before his election to a first term. And the energy in that voice is very different to the energy today, isn't it?
It is. I mean, President Trump is a man of very advanced years with several question marks over his health. That can't be ignored. And that is something which the last election highlighted in stark relief, where you had the two oldest candidates ever running against one another.
Now, the question of Trump's impunity and how that will, has it transformed American politics forever, or do you think the institutional strength of the U.S. can be rebuilt?
Well, this is the really fascinating thing because, and it shows the contrast with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon understood, and why he resigned, was that a lot of what makes Washington work is related to norms, not to black letter rules. Mm-hmm. And Trump and the Trump administration has happily shredded the norms of government. The idea that a president, according to National Public Radio in America, has personally enriched himself and his family by $2.2 billion over 2025, that would be unheard of. In fact, past presidents in the 1950s, when they retired, were quite strapped for cash. And that was the reality for a lot of post-presidencies. On top of that, there is a general change in how the courts have understood the presidency. So while speech has been considered a form, has now been translated into money through Citizens United back in 2010, more importantly now, in the last docket of decisions by the Supreme Court, Trump has the ability to dismiss senior officials. The only environment where he can't do that is the Federal Reserve.
And he tried.
He tried very hard, and it is not entirely clear that the Federal Reserve is fully independent, which, again, was something which, under the Clinton administration, was brought to its zenith, the independence of the Fed.
Knowing American politics as you do, the Democrats may well win the midterms. They may take the House. They could even take the Senate. And if they do, are they likely just to continue on to, they'll attempt to win the presidency in 2028? Continue as Trump did. In other words, he did this, so we will seize this power too and hold on to it. Or will they try to revert?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I think that there are significant long-term damage done by the Supreme Court in terms of the immunities and powers granted to the presidency, which the Democrats will probably not want to forego when they come into power. But at the same time, going back over several terms, the role of executive orders, of actually decanting more and more activity into the Oval Office, has expanded. And that has really been about the erosion of the role of the legislative branch of government. Yeah. And that is something which, if the Democrats come back into the House and retain the power of the purse, they must actively and forcefully assert that power in order to create another balance back into the three branches of government. Because right now, everything is being run straight from the Oval and nowhere else.
And you still are left with a Supreme Court that is lopsided?
You will always have a lopsided Supreme Court. The structure of the Supreme Court, going all the way back to Alexis de Tocqueville in the 19th century, highlighted that was the Achilles heel of the U.S. system, that you have life tenure and you have this appointment process, which is highly politicized. And right now it is clear that the courts are providing more and more opportunities for the White House to take over power. And that goes back to a theory of presidential power going back to the Nixon administration that Antonin Scalia was a great advocate of, which is the unitary executive theory.
Dr. Christian Larkin, Director of Research at the Institute of Policy Research at Bath University and co-director of the Kennedy Summer School in New Ross. Thank you very much for joining us. It runs from the 27th to the 29th of August, and listeners can get tickets and more information from kennedysummerschool.ie.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.